Hey, good evening, everyone. It's really wonderful to be back learning together. So thanks for coming out. And I figured in celebration of this milestone birthday of the State of Israel that we're, thank God, celebrating next week, we'd study some of the history, as the series is called, what is the series called? Zionists Before Zionism, to remind myself. And we talk about some of the history of what I call kind of movements of organized movements, longing and activism towards Zion, towards Israel, the land of Israel, prior to the advent of modern Zionism. So if modern Zionism begins in the late 19th century. The first Zionist Congress is in 1897. The movement begins a little bit before that. But certainly, as believing Jews, we know that Zion, has never been too far from the Jewish mind and the Jewish heart. And that has translated into activism and actual movements to not only think about and pray for Zion and to pray for Israel, but to, at different junctures in history, to actually try to get to Israel. So we're going to be doing three parts. I don't remember the other dates offhand. It's on alternating Tuesdays or something of that nature. So look at the schedule. Tonight we'll talk about one movement in the Middle Ages. The next time we'll talk about a couple of movements that are somewhat related in the kind of early modern period. And then we'll come to the last part to a movement which predates modern Zionism but is still in the modern period. So I need to give a little bit of introduction to, bless you, I need to give a little bit of an introduction to tonight's topic. Very briefly, before we get to the topic at hand, one of the main commentaries on the Talmud is what's known as the Tosafot. You may have heard of it. You may not have heard of it. There are handouts in the back over there. If you're coming in, I'm sorry. Okay. If you look at a page of Talmud, you don't like need to remember all this. I'm just trying to give some context for those that are not familiar. So if you look at a page of Talmud. So this here in the middle is the actual text of the Talmud. In the middle, this block on the left is what we call Rashi's commentary. And this block on the right is what we call the commentary of Tosafot. Tosafot were a group of, we don't know exactly how many, probably not more than a few hundred sages that lived in primarily northern France and Germany. In the about 12th and 13th centuries, for the most part, many of them were either descendants, students of students, descendants of Rashi, and they wrote a very, very essential, critical, and fundamental commentary to the Talmud. Why am I mentioning this? Why am I mentioning this commentary on the Talmud? We're not going to be learning Talmudic commentary. Oh, we'll mention one. But for the most part, not going to be studying Talmudic commentary tonight. Because the group of rabbis who we are going to be learning about historically tonight, for the most part, belong to this group known as the Baalei HaTosfot. So they're part of that group of a few hundred sages living in Central Europe, Western Central Europe, France and Germany, during this time period of the 12th and 13th centuries. So now, that brings us to the map that you have on the first page of your packet. Just again, this is all by way of introduction to give us some context. So I hope you can see it. It's actually a pretty good map that I found. These are centers of, as it says, these are centers of Ashkenazi, it says here in the top right-hand corner, centers of Ashkenazi rabbinical culture, 11th to 13th centuries. So approximately the period that we're I don't have any more. I apologize. Okay. Guess that's a good sign, but okay, I'll know for next time. Sorry about that. Okay. So as it says here, right, centers of Ashkenazi rabbinical culture, 11th to 13th centuries, and you see, right, they don't have, this is not a modern political map, so you don't have the borders that we now have, but this is primarily, if you're familiar with some of these place names, this is France, and this is Germany. And these are the centers and the cities and the towns in which these Baalei HaTosfot, these Ashkenazi scholars, functioned. So some of them that were more prominent in Germany, for example, Mainz, Worms, Speyer, in France, literally, you'll have to forgive my French, Troyes, I think it's pronounced, it's not Troy, I think it is Troyes, we'll go with that, right? Sounds good. Paris, even though it was not the Paris that we know of it today, but it was a pretty, already a rather large city, and there was a Jewish community there, and all of these various towns in primarily northern France and Germany, those were where these Baalei HaTosfot functions studied and taught. So that's, again, all of that is by way of introduction, that to understand that this is a group of scholars that we are talking about. One small addition really is that if you go to the top left-hand corner of your map, you'll see England. We don't necessarily associate Jewish scholarship in the Middle Ages with England, but there were Jewish scholars who lived in a few cities in England. The Jews were expelled from England in 1290, so obviously prior to that, there was Jewish scholarship, and even some of these, what we call, and what we've been calling the Baalei HaTosfot, who lived in London, who lived in Lincoln, in York, in some of these English cities. Okay, so you can turn to the next page, the second page, and we'll begin going through some of these sources. The first source is from a book called The Shevet Miyehuda. The Shevet Miyehuda was written a couple of hundred years after the period that we're talking about, but it's one of the first records that we have which records this aliyah, this quote-unquote mass movement is maybe somewhat of an exaggeration, but there's somewhat of a little mass movement, a semi-mass movement of scholars who make their way to Eretz Yisrael, to the Holy Land, in the 13th century. So, yeah. A 100%, right? So I don't have the numbers of how many, and I don't know if there are numbers, or there were numbers, I don't know if we have the numbers of how many Jews there were living in, let's say, northern France or Germany at the time. I don't know if we have accurate, I assume we don't have accurate records of those numbers. It's interesting that you're asking the question, because this source of the Shevet Miyehuda, its accuracy is somewhat questionable, or at least I'll put it this way, parts of the accuracy of this source are somewhat questionable, and you'll see what I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment, but it's a good point you're raising. Yeah, Luke.
I was wondering, the massacre of York, England, took place in about the middle of the 12th century.
Yeah.
And wouldn't that be a big inducement to the rabbinical scholars to relocate?
To leave England. Yes. We're actually, again, very good point you're raising. We'll see what their motivation was in leaving these centers of Jewish life and to move to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so let's see. Yes. We're going to talk about the crusade. Okay, I'm going to go home now and just let you guys do this. Okay, I don't need to be here. This is great. Okay, no, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. A good student. Okay. So, the Shevet Miyehuda, again, one of the first records that we have of this movement of Aliyah of the Baalei HaTosfot that we just mentioned, going in the beginning of the 13th century. So let's see what he says. In the year 4971, that's during the Jewish calendar, or which translates into 1211, God inspired the rabbis of France and England to go to Jerusalem. They numbered, okay, so listen to what he says, and this is why I titled, and this is not my title, but this is the title often given to this movement, the Aliyah of the 300 rabbis to Eretz Yisrael. It says, they numbered more than 300 and were accorded great honor by the king. We'll see who that might be. They built for themselves synagogues and houses of study, right? It sounds like, where did they do this? He mentioned in Jerusalem, right? Again, we'll talk about that. Our teacher, the great Kohen, Rabbi Jonathan HaKohen, his name was Rabbi Yonatan Miluniel. Luniel is a city in France. He was a very, very prominent scholar in the Middle Ages, went there as well. So he says that Rabbi Yonatan Miluniel was one of those 300 or so scholars that went on Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. A miracle occurred. They prayed for rain and were answered, and the name of heaven was sanctified because of them. So this is not your classical historical source that we would consider a modern historical source, right? You look up a modern historical source, they don't talk about praying for rain and being answered by God. So just as a general aside, whenever you see a source like this, you have to ascertain the accuracy of its historicity, right? Is it historically accurate? So one point that that scholars point to in terms of doubting, not the fact, we know for a fact that there was a relatively large group of scholars and people, not just scholars, but presumably people who left France and England during this time period in the year 1211 and made their way eventually to Eretz Yisrael. Now the Shevet Miyehuda cites the number of more than 300. Now, part of the reason that that figure itself is doubtful is because, going back to the introduction that we gave before, the whole institution of the Baalei HaTosfot, of these great scholars of France and Germany and England, didn't probably, in over the span of about two and a half centuries, probably did not number more than a few hundred. So it's hard to say that 300 of them picked up one day, right? Because there weren't 300 of them one day, right? It spanned the time period. So who were? So if there were in fact 300 people who left Central and Western Europe to go to Eretz Yisrael, if there were in fact 300 or more than 300, like he reports, it's possible that they weren't all these great scholars, these great rabbis. Maybe he's including some of their students, some of their supporters, right? People who went with them, maybe they were led by a group of great scholars of these Baalei HaTosfot, which we know there were great scholars amongst them, but presumably they weren't the only ones there, right? So there was a group led by these prominent rabbis, but included many other people as well. Good. So again, we know it happened. We know that, again, relatively large group of Jews left these centers of Jewish life in France and England and made their way to Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the 13th century. We're not 100% sure exactly how many, and we're not 100% sure what the exact makeup of the group was, but we do know that it included some other great names as well. I don't know if this name will mean anything to many of you. Rabbi Shimshon Mishantz, the Rash Mishantz, is also one of the great scholars of the Middle Ages who also, we think, was part of that group. And there were presumably others as well. So I said we're going to look at one commentary of the Tosfot in order to give us some context for the rest of tonight's discussion. So if you look at source number two, before we read the source itself, there's a discussion at the end of Masechet Ketubot about, I'm not going to get into all the intricacies of it, but about Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, what happens if one spouse wants to go, another spouse doesn't want to go. The Gemara has a whole, the Talmud has a whole discussion about this. The Tosfot, their comment, and makes what might seem to be a rather surprising comment. And again, think about also, we have to put this into historical context. So we're talking about when this comment was made. We know the name of the scholar that's quoted here. He lived at the end, he lived in the, I believe, the end of the 12th and the beginning of the 13th centuries. And this was presumably recorded a little bit after that. So listen to what is the Tosfot there comments in source number 2. I'm going to read it and translate into Hebrew. Follow along in either the Hebrew or the English. He says, "Eino noheg bazman hazeh." This does not apply nowadays. What's it? What does not apply nowadays? Aliyah. Says the Tosfot in this rather surprising comment that the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael does not apply nowadays. Nowadays meaning in the 12th and 13th century. Why? Two reasons are offered here. One, the ika sakanat drakim, because it's dangerous. It's dangerous to travel to Eretz Yisrael, which probably was, right? It was a lot more than a 12-hour, 10-hour, whatever flight. And it maybe was dangerous living there, I'm not sure. But certainly getting there was dangerous, and so he says, you don't have to put yourself in danger. Tosa says you don't have to put yourself in danger in order to go to Eretz Yisrael. The second reason that's offered, and that's in the name of this Rabbeinu Chaim. Rabbeinu Chaim, one of the prominent rabbis, the Baalei HaTosfot, he says, another reason there's no mitzvah to make aliyah, to move to Eretz Yisrael, is De'achshav einu mitzvah ladur be'eretz Yisrael ki yesh kama mitzvot ve'kama onshin de'ein ani yicholin lizayr bahen ve'la'amod aleihen. He says there, we know that there are various what we call mitzvot hatzliyot ba'aretz. There are a whole list of mitzvot that apply only in the land of Israel, primarily agricultural mitzvot. And he says, we don't know how to keep them. We don't want to mess up. Right, we can't. It's going to be difficult to keep them. We don't know how to keep them. It's very challenging to keep them. Again, at this point in time in the Middle Ages, and so he says, let's not get ourselves into that mess. So therefore, there's no mitzvah to move to Eretz Yisrael. So this was a very prominent, pronounced approach amongst the Baalei HaTosfot. In fact, this Rabbeinu Chaim, who's quoted here as saying there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, he actually lived in France. So wait a second. If the Baalei HaTosfot are saying there's no mitzvah to live and to move to Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden, a couple of decades later, this huge group of what? Of scholars from France and England pick up and move to Eretz Yisrael. Well, did they? Was this their opinion also, or was this not their opinion? And why wasn't it their opinion? So there are a couple of different approaches as to this question of, on the one hand, the approach, the opinion of Rabbeinu Chaim and the Baalei HaTosfot that there's no mitzvah to move to Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, we know practically hundreds, however the number was, did actually move to Eretz Yisrael. So one approach is that, and we'll, as we get further on, we'll see maybe why that is, that Rabbeinu Chaim, we said, lived at the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. And already at the beginning of the 13th century, things started to change. And even if people held of this opinion of Rabbeinu Chaim a little earlier on, for various reasons, some of which we'll see, maybe their minds were changed and they said, you know, nice to see you, Rabbeinu Chaim, but we're going to Eretz Yisrael anyway. So that's one approach. Another approach is, I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that Rabbeinu Chaim lived most of his life in France. However, in a wonderful article that I saw, actually traces the scholarship and the school of study of Rabbeinu Chaim not to France, even though that's where he settled, but actually to Germany. And so even within, right, so going back to our map, so even within the areas of the Baalei HaTosfot, Yes, they functioned in France, they functioned in Germany, but there wasn't a uniformity necessarily. So there were schools of study, schools of thought that were German, and there were schools of study and schools of thought that were French, and presumably some that were English. And so they had differences of opinion. So Rabbeinu Chaim was reflecting a German opinion. And in fact, we don't find, okay, so this is a very good proof for this theory, we do not find German rabbis picking up and moving to Eretz Yisrael at this time. But we do find these French rabbis picking up and moving to Eretz Yisrael. So if Rabbeinu Chaim and this opinion that there's no obligation to move to Eretz Yisrael might be reflective of this German school of thought, in which case they stayed in Germany, they didn't move to Eretz Yisrael, but the French did. So one of the main questions, this is really probably the main question that we're going to is why did they go? Why we're told that this happened in 1211, we know it happened in 1211. That's when they went to Israel. What motivated this group, again, relatively large group of Jews, including prominent scholars, to pick up and leave France and England and go on what the Tosfos was right, a pretty treacherous journey to get to Eretz Yisrael. So what was motivating them? So again, here we have a number of theories amongst historians. Not because I have really an opinion on this matter. I've never done my own real research on this. But really because I thought it was the most interesting one. Well, we're kind of going to work with one of those theories. But I do want to just briefly introduce the other one. One is that it was out of this deep piety that all of a sudden awakened in the communities of France and England, this great piety. How can we stay in the diaspora anymore? We must go and live in Eretz Yisrael in the Holy Land. That's one theory. Another theory, which may have been mentioned before, is related to the worsening conditions in particularly in France, but also in England at the time. And we know this is generally the pattern. Jews make aliyah when things are bad where they live, right? That's why we're here. That's why Americans don't make aliyah for the most part. Just a historical fact. It's not an opinion. It's just a historical fact, right? People generally make aliyah or move. It's not an aliyah versus an aliyah. People leave where they're living and move somewhere else when conditions are not good in where they are. So one theory is that the worsening conditions primarily in France, but also in England at the time, motivated them to leave and say, we have no future here, there's no future for us, there's no future for our families, let's move. So those are two theories. The third theory, which I found to be the most interesting, and that's the one which we'll focus on, is that particularly at this time period, amongst a number in Jewish history, there was a growing messianic fervor, a growing messianic feeling that the days of the Messiah, of the final redemption, are at hand. And who wants to be in France? You want to be in Paris when the Messiah comes? You don't want to be in Paris when the Messiah comes. Where do you want to be? You want to be in the center of it all, right? You want to be in Jerusalem, or at least in Eretz Yisrael, when the Messiah comes. And so there was a growing messianic fervor and feeling at this time period, which motivated and pushed these scholars and this group of Jews to leave where they were living and to go to Eretz Yisrael. Yeah, Jeff. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, very right. So often messianic movements are related to worsening. Yeah, 100%. Very good. Okay, very good point. We'll get there. To their what? I'm sorry? Oh, wives. I didn't see it. It's an interesting question. I didn't see anything. I don't have any reason to believe they left them behind. Doesn't sound good, right? It's like you know, summer in the Catskills gone amok, right? It's like, yeah. So again, we don't know the exact numbers, right? We don't know the exact numbers. Yeah, yeah. What's that? Yeah, I would assume so. I'd assume so. So where does this messianic fervor, why is it happening? Why is it growing at this point in time in the beginning of the 13th century, at this time period? I'm not going to go into all the intricacies of this, but this is related to certain Kabbalistic and mystical traditions. A lot of this is related to certain mystical traditions that you may have heard some of this. And certainly, once I say the word mysticism, I always say it's beyond my pay grade, but I'll just present kind of what I understand, a little some bullet points. There's a mystical tradition that the history of the world will be 6,000 years, right, corresponding to the 6 days of creation. So 6,000 years, the history of the world. Within that calculation, the last 1,000 years or so will be the days of the Messiah, will be the days of redemption. And the calculation came out that those 1,000 years of Yemot HaMashiach, of the days of redemption, will begin in the year 1240. Okay? And if you look through various mystical writings, it's actually very interesting that there were various calculations that were given as to when the Messiah will come. Many of them fall out on the secular calendar, on the right, the 40th year of the century. So 1240, 1440, up to 1840, which in Hasidic and mystical tradition, the year 1840 is also very significant for other reasons, but related, but connected and related, but not exactly the same reasons. So here they calculated that the year 1240 will be when these days of the Messiah will begin. So well, if it's in 1240, so let's get moving. Let's make sure that we're settled already in the land of Israel when the time comes. Okay. Why did they have to move? Why couldn't they just stay in France, stay in England? The Messiah will come, and we believe, right? Presumably, when the Messiah comes, one of the things which we're told the Messiah is going to do is what? Is ingather all of the exiles. So presumably, or I don't know exactly how that's going to happen. Allah will run extra lines, or I don't know. However, that's going to happen. But you could be in Paris, you could be in London, and you'll make your way to Eretz Yisrael when the time comes, when the Messiah comes. But no, they wanted to be there, and not just be there because it would be the center of the action when the Messiah comes. But they wanted to be there in a way, and we'll see a number of sources which point to this. But they wanted to be there to set the stage for the Messiah. They wanted to prepare not just themselves, prepare the land of Israel and prepare the world for the coming of the Messiah. Lloyd, did you have a... Yeah.
I was wondering, ain't about the same time that this was tail end of the Crusades?
Well, it depends which crusade you're talking about, right? There were, unfortunately, many of them. Well, there was the First Crusade, the Second Crusade, right? I think there were, I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to touch on the Crusades a little soon, okay? But, yeah.
Isn't also, this is the rise of the Catholic armies under the Pope, Catholic armies, and they were driving out the Moors from southern Spain and began to assert anti-Semitism throughout the Europe, West Europe.
Right. It's hard to say throughout Europe because it was so divided and there were so many different... So
wouldn't that serve as the impetus to have a pilgrimage to Israel?
Well, we'll see. There are some that think that maybe they tried to ride on the coattails of some of the crusaders, believe it or not, going to the Holy Land. But we're going to come back to that soon, okay? But I just want to see a couple of sources that reflect this idea of going to Eretz Yisrael, of being in Eretz Yisrael when the Messiah comes. So look at source number 3. These are not related to this time period, but I just wanted us to see this tradition, if you will, of A, calculating the Messianic age, and B, being there and preparing the land for the Messianic age. So for example, the Sefer HaKuzari, which is a fundamental work of Jewish philosophy, written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, he lived in the 11th century in Spain. So again, way before, and not geographically related to what we're talking about right now, but he says, Zotomeret, source number 3, Yerushalayim lo tibaneh, Jerusalem will not be rebuilt. Kim kasher yishtok ekuela b'nei Yisrael tachlit shukah. It's a beautiful statement of the Kuzari. He says, Jerusalem will not be rebuilt until there is a fiery, burning desire amongst the children of Israel for Jerusalem, ad asher yichonenu et avaneh v'et afarah, bringing them to reclaim its stones and its dirt. The Kuzari says that a precondition for the coming of the Messiah is that we actively go and rebuild Eretz Yisrael. And that's, again, this traditional feeling that may have motivated these Jews from France and England to go. At the same time, there, as I mentioned, these calculations going on as to when the Messiah comes. Parenthetically, there is a tradition within Jewish thought and history of calculating the times of the Messiah. It generally has not turned out very well, and generally brought about quite a bit of disappointment. And perhaps for that reason, there's also a very strong approach not to and to discourage such calculations. But perhaps I was actually very surprised when I saw this. None other than the Rambam himself, than Maimonides himself, who is the uber-rationalist, and you would think would not have, and in general, if you look at his work, Mishneh Torah, he discourages people from even talking and thinking about Mashiach so much. He says, focus on your service of God in this world, right? Don't think about Mashiach too much, which is, I like what the Rambam says there, right? But none other than the Rambam has a calculation for when the Mashiach will come in a different one of his writings. So the Rambam says here in source number 4, Ach yesh biyadi kabbalah nifla, he says, I have this wonderful tradition, says the Rambam. So he didn't come up with it, but he has this tradition and it's enough for him to record it. Right? So he thinks pretty highly of it, presumably. He says, Tashuv ha-nivua li-Yisrael, shnat, etc., etc., 12:12. He says that in the year 12:12, prophecy will return to Israel. He says there's no doubt that the return of prophecy will be a prelude to the coming of the Messiah. He says this is the truest of the ends which they have informed us, meaning which tells us what? That there were various calculations throughout history and throughout time, maybe even in the Rambam's time, but he thought that this one, starting in the year 1212, we're talking, they left in the year 1211, so we're talking about the same time period. The Rambam himself, again, shockingly, the ultra-rationalist, the Rambam himself got caught up, if you will, in some of this messianic fervor. Good. So I want to get back to what a couple of you have already mentioned in terms of the Crusades, and not just the Crusades, but this back and forth. If you look through medieval history, so much of I'm not a medievalist, but much of medieval history can be summarized as this seesaw between Christendom and Islam, right? This back and forth battle for dominance in Europe, in the Middle East, often focused on the Holy Land, for not just control of the Holy Land, but control of the Holy Land and of Jerusalem meant what? It meant religious dominance. That's how they interpreted it. So dominance between the world of Christianity and the world of Islam. Yeah, Jeff, what did you...
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that you're... So a couple of statements come to mind in the same Gemara in Ketubot, which talks about Eretz Yisrael in general. So two. One is the opinion of Rav Yehuda, who says that it is forbidden to leave Bavel, to leave Babylonia, and to settle in Eretz Yisrael. General, various reasons, I don't want to get into it. What's that? So hold on. So that's one opinion of Rav Yehuda, not generally accepted. The second one, which you're probably referring to, is what's called the Gimel Shvuot, right? The three oaths, which God, according to the Talmud, God swore the Jewish people to three oaths when he exiled us from Eretz Yisrael. And one of them is Shelo Ya'alu B'Chlama, that we shouldn't have a mass movement of moving to Eretz Yisrael. This becomes, what you're mentioning actually became a very prominent source of literature, the advent of Zionism, of modern Zionism, and particularly religious Zionism. The Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, focused most of his attitude towards Zionism and his fierce opposition to Zionism on that Gemara, on that passage in the Gemara. You're violating these oaths that the Gemara has. I don't want to go into this too much in depth, but there are various reasons why perhaps those oaths are not obligatory, either because they never really were obligatory. They're not a halachic, they're not in a halachic, a legal section of the Talmud that would obligate us. What's that?
I'm sorry, I'm saying that they just sworn to move us.
Yeah, maybe, I'm saying, but you mentioned those oaths, maybe because of that, maybe for other reasons as well, but yeah, they're, again, maybe we'll get to that actually in the third session. Maybe we'll talk about those oaths and why they may or may not be relevant. But okay. So we mentioned, and we're continuing to see some sources related to this messianism, but much of the messianism was also related, as some of you already alluded to or mentioned outright, to some of the geopolitical activity that's going on. As much as we like to think that we're at the center of the world, there is a world beyond Judaism and beyond the Jewish community, and a lot goes on there, in case you're not aware. And in the Middle Ages, a lot was going on. And like I said, there was this seesaw, this back and forth between Christianity and Islam. Who would be the dominant religion? Who would be the dominant force? And as we said, much of it was focused on control of Eretz Yisrael, of the Holy Land. So that's at least outright, and there are other reasons why various crusades took place, but at least outright it was to liberate, the Christian holy sites, and vice versa. The Muslims also have holy sites in Eretz Yisrael, and they wanted to take control of them and to drive out the Christians. So what's going on at this time period? So if you look at source number 5, we have a comment, a report of Rabbi Yehuda al-Kharizi. He was a traveler. He came from Spain originally. But he traveled, he spent much time traveling throughout the Europe and the Middle East at the time, during this period. And he reports as follows. And you'll see why it's so relevant to the messianic feeling that may be driving some of these rabbis and communities from France and England to go. So he writes here in source number 5, Ha'el or Akel Kinei Lishmo Vayachmol Alamo. God was jealous for his namesake, and he had compassion on his people. What did he do? How did God show that compassion? So he says, "Vayaer Elohim et ruach melech Yishme'elim b'shnat arbat alafim u'chamil v'chamishim li'tzira." The year 1190, he aroused upon them the spirit of the king of the Ishmaelites, meaning who? Ishmaelites meaning Muslims, right? So he aroused the king of, who is, anyone know who he might be referring to? 1190. A very prominent, there wasn't one king of the Muslims at the time, but what? Saladin. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, not Suleiman. Suleiman's later. Saladin of Egypt. Okay? That's who he's referring to. And he says, Baya'al hu v'chol chelo mi Mitzrayim. He rose together with all of his army from Egypt. He says, God gave Jerusalem into the hand of Saladin, right? Which is an interesting way of viewing it, right? Meaning, if God gave it into the hands of Saladin, it must be beneficial for whom? For the Jews. It must be good for the Jews, as they say, right? Vayetzav leha'avir kol ba'ir le'mor, and he, Saladin, commanded that they should announce the following, le'mor dabru alev Yerushalayim, which is, of course, a paraphrase from Isaiah, lavo eleha kol harotzeh mizera Ephraim, everyone from the seed of Ephraim, meaning all, any Jew, should come and settle in Jerusalem at the time. So he's reporting that Saladin was good to the Jews. He just conquered Jerusalem, and not only that, but he invited Jews to come and settle there. It's almost like, right, not an exact analogy, but like a medieval Balfour Declaration almost, right? Where this great superpower favorably sees the settlement of Jews in this case, Jerusalem, maybe in other parts of the land of Israel as well. And you can imagine what that's doing to Jews who hear about this in the diaspora, who say, wow, maybe this is it, right? Maybe the Messiah is coming. Maybe God is preparing the world for the coming of the Messiah by allowing us to return to Eretz Yisrael, much like, right, fast forward to the 20th century when the Balfour Declaration came out. It was a sign to many people that this was a sign from heaven, that the superpower, in that case England, was inviting Jews to some degree to come to settle in Eretz Yisrael. And again, very often when there is tumult, when there is this constant back and forth upheaval, would be a better word, when there's this upheaval in the world, for many people that is a sign of messianism. I think you mentioned that before, Rabbi Kahn, right? So again, if we bring analogies, history does repeat itself. World War I for many was a messianic sign. World War II for many was a messianic sign. I'm not here to interpret whether they are or they were or they not. But the point is that when there's, on the one hand, a report like this, where the Muslims have conquered Jerusalem and invited Jews back, and then a few years later, a few years later, the Christians take over again, and then the Muslims take over again, and all of this upheaval and this back and forth for many is interpreted not just in geopolitical terms and historical terms, but in spiritual terms, and particularly as it pertains to messianism. Go to the next source, number 6. So we said before that not only did Jews think that the Messiah will come and bring them to Eretz Yisrael, but that they need to be in Eretz Yisrael and prepare it for the coming of the Messiah. And we see that. I actually want to skip to source number 7, excuse me, and then we'll come back to source number 6. I should have put them in different order, apologize. But in source number 7, we have this anonymous kind of pronouncement that was found from that period. And it says over there, Va'al ya'ale alev adam lomar, it shouldn't even cross your heart, your mind, to say, She'yigale melech ha-mashiach al eretz lo tehora. Don't think for a moment that the Messiah is going to appear on an impure land, meaning outside of Eretz Yisrael. He's not going to come to the diaspora first and then make his way to Eretz Yisrael. Ve'al yishge adam lomar she'yigale be'eretz Yisrael ben ha'goyim. And don't think that he's going to appear and reveal himself in Eretz Yisrael amongst the Gentiles, amongst the nations. Ela davar barur, it says, it's clear to us, she'yihiyu be'eretz Yisrael, that there must be, and listen to the words that he uses, that there must be in the land of Israel, tofsei ha'torah ve'achasidim v'anshei ma'aseh midalad ruchot ha'olam, that in Eretz Yisrael you must have great Torah scholars, you must have righteous people, pious people, in order for the Messiah to come, appear, and reveal himself. And so we said before, who was leading this movement? We're great Torah scholars. And they were the ones that were leading this movement to go to Eretz Yisrael. And they very much encapsulated this feeling that they need to be the trailblazers, right? They need to be the ones that are there. So what does this have to do, right? This doesn't mention a place name. This doesn't mention that they need to be French scholars or English scholars. So where does the France come in? So now go back to source number 6 for a moment. We're going to see 6 and then 8. In source number 6, we have, this is interestingly, a source that was found in the Cairo Geniza. How things made their way to Cairo is a whole nother, for a whole number, another talk. But in any case, this was found in the Cairo Geniza, and he says, "Higiu michtavim mitzarfat." So here France is named specifically. Letters have arrived from France, shekam b'nehem navi, that a prophet has risen among them. Meaning this guy, someone is walking around, presumably northern France, and like a prophet, and proclaiming he's a prophet, right? So generally we call those people crazy, but okay, this is reported, right? The Amar, and he said, Shabishnat 1226 Yatfil, he said that in the year 1226, it's all going to start, what, it being the redemption. HaKibbutz HaGadol Yavo Adoneinu Eliyahu, that our master Elijah Eliyahu, a Navi, is going to come. Uvishnat 1233 Yavo Mashiach ben David, and in 1233, the Mashiach himself will come. V'tashuv mamlechet lebat Yerushalayim, sovereignty will return to the daughter of Jerusalem, meaning to the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So whether or not this person was crazy, right? But clearly it's reflective of something that's going on, of the zeitgeist, of this spirit that is prevalent in France at the time. And perhaps, as was suggested, and we said, there are various theories as to what motivated this group of scholars to pick up and go to Eretz Yisrael. But it's clear that there was some sort of messianic feeling going on based on various mystical calculations and developed therein further. Yeah, Phil. So my understanding, again, take it or leave it, is that part of what the Mashiach will bring about is an understanding and a realization of Hashem and of God. Not that it's a prerequisite. Right? And I believe the Rambam talks about that as well, that it's a consequence of the coming of the Messiah, not a prerequisite. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering, the Christians, the remnants of the Crusaders that held Jerusalem, expelled the Jews during their occupation.
Mm-hmm.
When the Italians conquered Jerusalem, the Yavatri, they expelled all the Christians.
Yeah.
And then the Jews came and fulfilled that vacuum.
That the Christians were expelled?
Yes.
By Saladin?
Why? And then the Jews were able to come in once again.
I think so, yeah. Okay, so just one other source related to France, and then we'll start to wrap up. One other source related to France to kind of drive this point home. One of the great scholars of French Jewry during the Middle Ages, whose name was Rabbi Yechiel Miparis, Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. He had a yeshiva in Paris. If you're parenthetically, if you've heard of the burning of the Talmud in Paris in the year 1240, he was the rabbi who was part of that whole dispute, who obviously lost, and then the Talmud was burnt as a result. But Rabbi Yechiel Miparis, this very, very prominent French rabbi, is reported in source number 8 as saying, Rabbi Yechiel Miparis, he's a little later, okay, so he's slightly, He came to Eretz Yisrael, we think, a little bit later, not in 1211. Okay, but again, it's reflective of just the general feeling and spirit of the time. Rabbi Chiyo Mipariz, source 8, Amar Lavol Yerushalayim, he said, he's reported as saying, to come to Jerusalem. And what's he going to do there? Believe it or not, v'sheyakriv korbanot bazman hazen, he's going to offer sacrifices at that time. Question of whether you can offer sacrifices in the absence of a temple is a real question that was debated over the centuries. So this, at least, they're reporting in the name of Rabbi Yechiel Mipariz that he wanted to do this. So again, another reflection on what may have motivated them. So the question, we've now explained one theory, at least, as to what brought them there. And now we just have to wrap up by saying what? Well, what happened to them once they got there, right? We want to know the end of the story. Don't leave us hanging here. So what happened? It's not, you can imagine the history of Jews in the Middle Ages, it's not necessarily the happiest ending. But they come, some settle in Jerusalem. They do come in 1211, this group of, let's say 300, right, for argument's sake. They come and some settle in Jerusalem, but they did not last. And many make their way to Akko, so on the northern coast of a Mediterranean coast of Israel, they make their way to Akko. What was an Akko? Anyone? The Crusader fortress. Right? It was actually a pretty active town, and the Crusaders, I guess, welcomed there, or tolerated them at least, and they settled in Akko and they established a yeshiva in Akko, and that became the main community of French Jews, of these Ashkenazi French Jews at the time, to the degree that if you look at source number 9, it's a great source. This is from the Chuvos HaRashba. The Rashba, not related to this story at all, except for this source, the Rashba lived, he was a leader of Spanish Jewry at the time, lived in, I believe, Barcelona. He was a leader of Spanish Jewry. But he was a main, and until this day, a pillar of halakhic legal opinion. And he writes about this yeshiva in Akko and just how highly it was regarded. So it's a great source where he says, Minag b'kol chachmei Eretz Yisrael v'chol chachmei Bavela sho'alim she'ela, that the custom of all the sages of the land of Israel and all the sages of Babylonia, whenever they ask a question, lo yachtom b'shum adam, they don't, no one signs on an answer, right? Meaning they don't give their own answer. They don't provide their own opinion. Either, probably exaggerating a little bit, but they don't provide their opinion. But what would they do? V'kach omrim, they would rather say, Yorunu chachmei Akko. Mishei lat kach lakach. They won't sign on it, or they won't give their own opinion until they get the opinion of the sages of Akko. So you see just how highly regarded those sages and that yeshiva and that community of learning was in Akko, which was a result, an outgrowth of these 300 rabbis, scholars, community members who came to Eretz Yisrael in the beginning of the 13th century. One last, I said doesn't have, the story doesn't have the greatest of endings. One reason that is, as I said, that they first, many of them tried to settle in Jerusalem, but they were unsuccessful. So this is, we're going to fast forward a little bit, but just to give us again a sense of what the situation in the land was at the time, this is a letter that the Ramban, Nachmanides, wrote. So the Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael himself much later, towards the end of the 13th century. We're pretty sure he arrived in Eretz Yisrael, and he writes a letter from there back to, I believe, Spain, to his son who remained in Spain, and he writes as follows. Yerushalayim, it's a sad report he gives. He says, Yerushalayim chareva min hakol. He says, Jerusalem is more desolate than anything else. And he's reporting what he's seeing as he arrived in Eretz Yisrael. The Eretz Yehuda yoter min haGalil, Judah, the area of Judah is more desolate than the Galilee. Ve'im churbanah hi tova me'od ve'yoshvim karov le'alpayim. He says that in Judah, it seems, right, in Judah there were about 2,000 inhabitants. V'notzrim b'tocha k'shlosh me'o plitim me'cherev ha-sultan, right? There were about 300 Christians in Judah. V'ein Yisrael b'tocha, but no Jews. Okay, so amongst the 2,000 inhabitants of Judah, 300 were Christian. Do the math, that means about, 2,000, right? So 1,700 of them are Muslim, presumably, with no Jews. Doesn't mean exactly no Jews, because look at what he says now. Ki me'et ba'u atatarim, he says the Tatars, right? Which really means the Mongols. Kind of like a lot of these terms were used interchangeably. So the I said there was a back and forth always. Right? Eretz Yisrael is, for better or for worse, a very popular destination amongst world powers. And so at one point the Mongols came and kicked the Christians. The Mongols were he means Muslims, right? And kicked the Christians out, yeah? Okay, as well as the Jews. Kimi eit bau ha-tatrim, meaning the Mongols. Barchu misham vehem nehergu b'charvam. They, presumably Christians and Jews, were killed by their sword of the Mongols. And now listen to what he describes about the situation of Jews in Jerusalem at the time. 1267, he says, Rak shnei achim tzaba'im. There were two brothers who were painters. That was their business. They were painters. Konim hatzva'im min ha-moshel. They would buy their paint from the governor. Okay, not so important for us right now. But the Elehem Ya'asfu ad Midyan mitpalalim beveitam b'shabbatot. They would succeed in gathering up to a minyan in their house on Shabbos. So meaning during the week there was no minyan, and there was barely a minyan on Shabbos. And this is what the Ramban reports that he found in Jerusalem in 1267. So from all of those 300 and that great fervor and that great, and that great spirit and yearning for Jerusalem and for Eretz Yisrael of those 300 rabbis and scholars that came from France and England, if this is 1267, so they came approximately 55, 56 years prior to that. There's nothing left of them in Jerusalem. What happened, and then I'll take your question, okay? What happened in Akko? So we said that they were able to establish a community and a yeshiva in Akko, one that was highly regarded, as we saw. So Akko was, we said, the Crusader center. In 1291, the Mamluks, which was another Islamic group, came and conquered Akko and slaughtered many of their inhabitants. And amongst the Jews, some moved, left Akko, and they fled Akko and moved to other parts of Eretz Yisrael, and some left Eretz Yisrael completely, presumably returned back to most probably to their homelands in France. So again, it's a story of it's an interesting story driven by messianism, perhaps, which is a common theme and a repeating theme throughout Jewish history, which brings Aliyah, which brings people looking towards Zion, towards the Holy Land. It's not perhaps a very successful one, as was the story of Jews in many times in history, but certainly one that is perhaps inspiring nonetheless, of Jews who, despite all the difficulties and the challenges, really did make their way to Eretz Yisrael, led by none other than some of their great leaders. So, yeah.
One thing that is recovering to me is I'm not quite sure what would be considered a Zion or when it comes to the people in the Middle Ages. So the Ramban, for example, says specifically the land, the territory that used to be Judea and the Galilee. Akko is neither. So again,
interesting. The Talmud itself has a discussion about the status of Akko, actually, specifically, but yeah.
So again, you know, all these places. There, you know, so it's all the things that we think about because of the modern map of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
Right, we think of those things, but again, what is middle?
I don't know what each one of them. The Ramban that you're mentioning himself had a pretty expansive. If you look at his writings, he had a pretty expansive view of what the mitzvah. The Ramban is very much of the opinion that there's a mitzvah to live and to conquer the land of Israel, and he has a pretty expansive view of what that land of Israel is. But he's a realist also, and he realizes where he could go and where he can't go. It's interesting, we don't know actually what happened to the Ramban, really. We don't know where he's buried, we don't know what happened to him. We think, we're pretty sure he reached Eretz Yisrael, but we're not sure exactly what happened to him. Yes, Susan? There is the more famous Ramban synagogue is in the Old City. I don't think it has anything to do with the actual arrival of the Ramban, or it's just named after him because he got there, but I'm not sure. So, right, so again, maybe if that's true, you have to ask yourself, what's a presence? A presence could mean a barely a minion, or it could mean thousands, right? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm wondering, has archaeological findings given any authoritative input where they found evidence of Jewish communities back in ancient times? Has that given us any hint as to what is considered Eretz Yisrael?
I mean, I don't know for sure. It's not my area of expertise by any stretch. We certainly have archaeological evidence of Jews throughout the Galilee, the Golan, you know, stretching to Syria. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's reflective of Eretz Yisrael, because Jews have lived in the diaspora for thousands of years also. So just the fact that there was a Jewish community doesn't mean that they thought that they were living in Eretz Yisrael necessarily, right? I don't think so necessarily, because again, I mean, the diaspora goes back to pretty ancient times as well, right? So it's, I don't know if that would be an indicator necessarily. Okay, so thank you very much. So I think it's in 2 weeks, but look at the schedule. I don't remember the dates offhand. What?
It's on May 2nd.
May 2nd, thank you. We're going to fast forward to the 18th and 19th century, and we'll talk about the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, their opponents, who each had visions of leading movements to Eretz Yisrael. So have a good night.
Thank you.